With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us today on the AgNet News Hour. Coming up later, why maintaining good trade relations with China is imperative for California pistachios. And also, we continue our conversation with Stanislaus County Agriculture Commissioner Linda Pinfold. But our top story today, with one season left in the western water season, how does the region look regarding reservoir levels and mountain snowpack accumulations? Rod Bain reports.
More western reservoirs remain at or above capacity for water storage as spring soon approaches.
Things remain in pretty good shape, and that's largely due to what happened last winter when we had that incredibly wet western winter that led to significantly above average precipitation and snowpack virtually from the Mexican border to the Canadian border and beyond, a very active season. And for that reason, we see reservoir storage statewide above average in 9 of our 11 western states.
And he adds, for those reservoirs already with significant water storage,
that doesn't even include what's going to come in terms of runoff for this year, because here we are, late February, early March. Most of what is going to run off into those reservoirs is still stored as snowpack at this time and won't melt for a few more weeks.
Most areas in the West report excellent snowpack and precipitation totals with 1 month left in the western water season, with particular emphasis on the southern two-thirds of the West.
Stretching from Oregon to southern Wyoming and all points south have average to above average snowpack for the most part as we head into the final month of the 2023-2024 wet season.
With much of the area improving its snowpack totals after a slow start to the water accumulation season, Rippey says the best example of this is found in the Sierra Nevada mountain range, which supplies most of California's irrigation and municipal water.
In the Sierra Nevada, as we started 2024, we only had about 2.5 inches of liquid stored in that Sierra Nevada snowpack starting the new year. That improved by about 6 inches during January and another 10 inches approximately during February. So that has pushed the Sierra Nevada snowpack average water equivalency by the end of February to more than 18 inches. That hasn't completely caught us up to normal, but it gets us up to about 80% of normal.
And expected March storm activity could provide several more inches of snowpack in the Sierra Nevada before season's end on April 1st. However, near to below normal snowpack is found in the northern tier of the West.
There's only parts or all of four states that are really struggling in terms of snowpack. Those four, Washington and Montana, along with northern sections of Idaho and Wyoming. Those areas have come up a little bit short on precipitation and snowpack this winter, and snowpack at this time in some of our driest basins running broadly less than 70% of average for the end of February. That portends that we'll have below average runoff in those areas. And so in states like Washington, where reservoir storage is already below average, we will likely see some water supply issues as we move through the spring and summer of 2024.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
U.S. exports of agricultural products this year will fall below those of 2023. Gary Crawford has more.
A better 2024 ag export forecast than was expected 3 months ago, but still, USDA is projecting exports this year to come in at $170.5 billion, down about $8 billion below fiscal 2023.
And so that would be a 5% decrease from 23 to 24 if this forecast were realized.
USDA economist Bart Kinner says to explain the downturn, you have to do what they did in that movie Casablanca.
Round up the usual suspects.
Ah, yes, and the first suspect, a continued strong dollar.
And that creates opportunity for other competing countries to sell their comparable products at a lower price.
And that brings us to reason number two, stiff crop production competition. USDA's chief economist Seth Meyer told us,
as we have seen commodity prices fall, supplies around the world rebound, particularly in South America, so we face more export competition. That's really, that is what is moving our export total down.
especially for corn and soybeans. Nonetheless, though, our main export customers are continuing to buy from us. Let's take a look at our primary buyers for a second here. Seth Meyer says even though USDA has lowered its 2024 forecast for China's purchases of U.S. ag products, lowered it by almost $1 billion.
We still project that China is going to be the top export market for us in 2024.
Meyer says right now, China is expected to buy $28.7 billion worth of U.S. ag products. If that happens, it would make China our top customer.
But boy, Mexico and Canada, much closer to home, are right in there at about the same level.
USDA expects Mexico to boost its purchases of U.S. ag products to a record high, $28.4 billion.
So Mexico being number two, very close to China, and very close to Mexico being Canada.
Canada projected purchases, $28 billion. So of the projected $170.5 billion of U.S. exports to all nations, China, Mexico, and Canada are going to account for about 49% of it. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
This is the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will be back in just a moment with more of the day's agriculture news. You are listening to the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. In today's National Spotlight, the Environmental Protection Agency's recently announced Office of Agriculture and Rural Affairs is among the latest efforts to build partnership and relationship between the agency and the ag sector. Rod Bain reports.
It was noted that Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Michael Regan's visit to the 2024 Commodity Classic in Houston was the first ever by an incumbent administrator.
During my visits to family farms over the past 3 years, I've observed numerous ways you all are using innovation to improve productivity and profitability while also reducing environmental impact. I've seen precision irrigation equipment, an aerial drone sprayer, GPS technology, a cover crop interseeder, a water reuse pond, and solar panels on barns all across this country.
Administrator Regan also acknowledged the need for his agency and the ag sector to develop stronger relationships to address various issues such as climate challenges. To that end, this announcement.
An important step that will help solidify EPA's relationship in the agriculture sector for the future.
With the establishment of an EPA Office of Agriculture and Rural Affairs.
To expand engagement opportunities beyond any that we've done so far, and to ensure that your voices are heard and that your ideas are understood.
The administrator announced that his senior advisor for ag, Rod Snyder, will head the new office.
With the establishment of this new office, we will ensure agriculture and rural stakeholders have a continual seat at the table at EPA for many years to come.
Additionally,
recognizing these tremendous challenges, I've recharted EPA's Farm, Ranch, and Rural Communities Federal Advisory Committee in 2021, and I've asked that committee to help ensure and evaluate how EPA's tools and programs can best advance our nation's agricultural, climate mitigation, and adaptation goals.
EPA and the Agriculture Department recently reached a memorandum of understanding enabling EPA to reference Natural Resources Conservation Service practices on pesticide labels to help growers meet Endangered Species Act requirements. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack says this MOU exemplifies the relationship between the two entities, and more important, the improving lines of communication to help EPA understand the needs of agriculture.
Now you've got this office, so there's an easier vehicle for that to take place, and I can reinforce what farmers are telling you directly. But we need to educate EPA as it does its work about what this is going to be the impact.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
That's today's National Spotlight. Now with more livestock news, here's Will Jordan.
In today's livestock news, Texas ranchers have been battling intense wildfires since last week. Over 1 million acres of the Texas Panhandle have been impacted. The effects of this wildfire will impact cattle producers across the nation. The USDA Cattle Inventory report published earlier this year showed that Texas was the leader in the U.S. cattle industry. USDA reported 12 million head in the state, accounting for 13.77% of the total U.S. cow herd. Texas Department of Agriculture Commissioner Sid Miller said in a February 28th press release that 85% of the Texas cow herd is in the Panhandle, the region directly impacted by this disaster. Commissioner Miller said, quote, "The Smokehouse Creek fire is closing in on becoming the largest fire on record in Texas. These fires not only threaten lives and property, but will also have a substantial impact on our agricultural industry. Over 85% of the state's cattle population is located on ranches in the Panhandle. There are millions of cattle out there, with some towns comprising more cattle than people. The losses could be catastrophic for those counties. Farmers and ranchers are losing everything. End quote. At historic lows, the U.S. cow herd needs a rebound, yet this event provides another hit to an industry already in limbo. Beyond the cattle lost in the blaze, this catastrophic event could cause record culling numbers to be seen again this year, as rangeland will take time to regrow, putting producers in a tight spot. Continued growth in calf prices and increasing value of mature cows could be expected. The intensity of the blaze was curtailed some at the end of last week as weather patterns shifted. USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey shares more.
During the extreme heat and wind of Monday and Tuesday, we saw a number of grass fires and wildfires develop across North Texas. And the largest five of those fires have burned more than 1 million acres of vegetation, mostly grassland in the Texas Panhandle. Most of the fires have been burning in the Canadian River Basin, and just a handful of fires burning in the Red River Valley, which eventually moves eastward to serve as the border along the Oklahoma-Texas line. A couple of the fires have burned out of Texas and into western Oklahoma and have become multi-state events. The largest active fire is the Smokehouse Creek Fire. That's one of the Canadian River Valley fires, and it has burned an incredible 850,000 acres, and in doing so has become the second largest wildfire in Texas state history. Most of that, fortunately, burning across open country, but unfortunately, we have heard reports of at least one fatality and also some livestock being killed by the fast-moving flames.
Texas Governor Greg Abbott declared a disaster in 60 counties as the Texas Department of Agriculture State of Texas Agriculture Relief Fund, or STAR Fund, is calling for donations to assist Texas Panhandle farmers and ranchers. The STAR Fund mobilizes resources to support affected agricultural producers. Funded 100% through donations, TDA reimburses qualified agricultural producers 50% of eligible expenses. Though it cannot be used as compensation for crop or livestock losses, STAR Fund financial resources can be used to rebuild fences, restore operations, and cover other expenses related to agricultural disaster relief and restarting operations. For more information on how to support Texas farmers and ranchers impacted by the wildfires, visit TexasAgriculture.com. I'm Will Jordan for AgNet West.
This is the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson, and we will be back in just a moment. Welcome back to the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Coming up in a few moments, we'll have today's This Land of Ours report, but first, more of the day's agriculture news. And with today's AgNet West headlines, here's AgNet West Farm News Director, Brian German.
Maintaining good trade relations with China is critical for American pistachios. UC Cooperative Extension Specialist Brittany Goodrich pointed out where China fits in as an important foreign market for pistachios.
In terms of U.S. exports, our main countries that we're exporting to are the biggest one by far is China and Hong Kong. We export a lot of our pistachios to European Union countries like Germany and Belgium. But like you said, in terms of global exports, India is certainly a growing market. And you can see over the last decade or so, India has increased their imports of pistachios, not just from the US, but from other countries as well, quite substantially. And so I think that's something that we're going to be seeing as a growing market going forward for all tree nuts, not just pistachios. But you have this growing middle class in India that has more disposable income. And so they're now importing more tree nuts from the U.S. and from other countries. So that's a particularly big growing market. But again, the major player for us in terms of U.S. exports is definitely China. So maintaining those good trade relationships with China is really imperative for our pistachio industry here.
As part of a partnership with Payne Schwartz Partners and British Columbia Investment Management Corporation, Driscoll's has acquired the prominent Australian fresh produce company Costa Group. Founded in the late 1800s, Costa has evolved into a global leader in horticulture, offering premium quality produce like blueberries, tomatoes, citrus, avocados, mushrooms, and grapes, with a distribution network spanning numerous countries. The acquisition builds upon Driscoll's existing relationship with Costa, dating back to 2010, and includes joint ventures in Australia and China. Driscoll's CEO Soren Bjorn emphasizes the strategic significance of the investment, highlighting the substantial value in Costa's portfolio and its long-term growth potential. The partnership aims to enhance the global berry business while maintaining operations in China, Australia, and the Americas. The U.S. Department of Agriculture has announced $26 million in funding for the Local Agriculture Market Program to support local and regional food systems development. The funding aims to bolster producer-to-consumer marketing, local food markets, and enterprises. The program targets projects enhancing access to locally grown food and creating new markets, including farmers markets and food hubs. Two key funding opportunities within LAMP, the Farmers Market Promotion Program and the Local Food Promotion Program, seek to develop, coordinate, and expand local and regional food systems. The program prioritizes smaller farms, new farmers, underserved communities, and socially disadvantaged producers. USDA's Agricultural Marketing Service is accepting grant applications via grants.gov until May 14th. Webinars and other resources are available to assist with the application process. The last storm system that came through California has pushed the state's snowpack up to average. Last week, when the Department of Water Resources conducted their manual snow survey, the statewide snowpack was measured at just 81% of the average. The Northern Sierra was in the best condition at 91% of the average, while the Central and Southern Sierras were at just 77%. Thanks to the cold storm front that California experienced over the weekend, the statewide snowpack was measured at 104% of the average on Monday. The Northern Sierra remains in the best condition at 111% of average. The Central Sierra increased to 104%, and the Southern Sierra improved to 94% of the average. Overall, the statewide summary shows the snowpack at 94% of the April 1st average, with a snow water equivalent of 24.4 inches. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network. National Groundwater Awareness Week is set to kick off on March 10th as a means to highlight the responsible development, management, and use of groundwater. The California Department of Water Resources will be commemorating the occasion through a variety of online events scheduled from March 11th through the 15th. A webinar featuring DWR Director Carla Nemeth, DWR Deputy Director of Sustainable Groundwater Management Paul Gosselin, and others will take place on March 11th and will focus on the progress made over the first 10 years of the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act. Other webinars throughout the week will include outreach and engagement training for groundwater sustainability agencies, groundwater sustainability plan reporting process and requirements, and planning for the future with data, tools, and models. Information on how to participate in the webinars is available at water.ca.gov. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
A new conservation initiative from NRCS. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. The Department of Agriculture is launching a new conservation initiative, the Working Lands for Wildlife's Northern Bobwhite Pilot Project. NRCS has also announced the sign-up dates for USDA's general enrollment sign-up in the Conservation Reserve Program, which opens March 4th. Both conservation opportunities give producers tools to conserve wildlife habitat while achieving other conservation benefits, including sequestering carbon and improving water quality and soil health. The Working Lands for Wildlife Northern Bobwhite Pilot Project is a new effort supporting voluntary conservation of private working lands to benefit the northern bobwhite quail and east central grasslands conservation. This is for producers to help the bobwhite and other game and non-game species by managing their working lands for early successful habitat while meeting their land's natural resource and production goals. Producers and landowners interested in either opportunity should contact the FSA and NRCS at their local service center. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
This is the AgNet News Hour. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Welcome back. A new report can help farmers analyze their crop risks and opportunities. Michael Clements reports.
Pattern Ag uses analytics to help farmers optimize their spending on crop protection, seed selection, and fertility inputs while improving the long-term productivity of their land. Danielle Watts, VP of Data, Pattern Ag, says the 2024 Predictive Ag Report is backed by a large amount of data.
We analyzed more than 200 billion genetic reads from soil samples taken across the Midwest, and they form a soil metagenomics database, which is the world's largest soil metagenomic database. We put all of that information together and package that into our predictive ag report. One of the key ways in which we really drive our understanding of what's happening in these fields is through a large research program we have. It's called the Pattern Ag Growers Initiative, where we're working directly with commercial growers to understand the impacts of their field management on the soil biology, as well as what sort of links there are between the soil biology and their yield outcome.
The Soil Productivity Index provides benchmarks of yield potential for farmers to compare their fields against.
So what we've done is taken years of grower information, including yield, as well as all of their soil biology and chemistry, and put that together in a way that really helps explain how far off are you from the potential yield that you could be getting. Are you pretty much maximizing out the yield through your management practices of the soil on your farm, or are there opportunities for you to dive in a level deeper and really increase your soil productivity potential?
The report can help growers make crop input decisions for the growing season.
We produce an almanac every year where we're pinpointing the regions with the highest risk of pest and pathogen outbreaks. And these are really detailed maps that are going to look at pathogens as well as what sort of upcoming risks we're seeing in terms of biofertility. And then diving a layer deeper this year, we've also released a bunch of foliar insights. So where are we seeing regions of high foliar pathogen loads? We're also providing a lot of insights about where we're seeing significant yield differences based on the pathogen loads in the field. So this year is a sort of new release around that where we're able to say, here's where we're seeing significant yield losses.
This is the second year that Pattern Ag has published the Predictive Ag Report. Watts offers an example of what growers can expect.
We saw something really interesting going on in north central Iowa in particular, where we were seeing between 30 and 80 bushels per acre lower corn in fields that were really high risk for fusarium root rot, northern corn leaf blight, tar spot, and anthracnose of corn. Since the average yield for corn in this region is around 200 bushels per acre, our growers in that region where we saw low fusarium, they were upwards around 240 bushels per acre. And in contrast, fields really high in fusarium were averaging about 150 bushels per acre in 2023. What that tells us is that there's a really significant opportunity to be a little bit more aggressive in the management of some of these root rots to achieve that top end yield that's possible in that region.
Copies of the 2024 Predictive Ag Report can be downloaded online at www.pattern.ag. Michael Clements reporting.
Conservation engineers are helping thousands of farmers and ranchers to do vital environmental work. Gary Crawford has more on this edition of Agriculture USA.
Now, I know this is going to seem totally incredible to you, but a few days ago, somehow, some way, a few of us did not pick up on the fact that from February 18th through the 24th, it was National Engineers Week. Well, that's true. So what exactly is an engineer anyway?
It's anyone who basically uses ingenuity to solve problems.
Ingenuity, engineer. I heard what you did there, Kevin.
All right. Let me try to do that one again, okay?
No, that was clever. Don't worry, too. We're going to introduce you formally in just a minute when we find out what engineers have to do with Agriculture USA. I'm Gary Crawford.
Come all you rounders if you want to hear the story about a brave engineer. Casey Jones was the roller's name on a 6'8" wheeler, boys, he rode to fame.
So engineers come in all types and sizes, from the old traditional railroad engineer to flight engineers to those who build dams and roads and bridges. So now let's officially meet Kevin Farmer. Yes, Farmer. He directs conservation engineering for the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Natural Resources Conservation Service, NRCS.
Our engineers are conservation-type engineers, those who solve problems to help protect natural resources throughout the environment.
And to that end, many of these engineers often work directly with farmers, ranchers, and other landowners.
You know, helping folks do their thing with the land is awesome.
Awesome. New voice there. That's Andy Dykert. He's an award-winning USDA state conservation engineer working out of West Virginia. That's a state with a lot of livestock. And so
we help the farmers with waste storage structures to handle their manure, and they can store that in structures until it's beneficial for them to spread it on their fields. We also help improve their water for their livestock. We may develop springs or help them build farm ponds with pipelines to watering facilities.
Many engineers also help design, build, and maintain flood control dams and such.
our engineers are a big part of what we do every day.
That's another new voice, Terry Cosby. He runs the USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service. He says the engineers work with farmers and ranchers directly to design and install systems with names that most of us non-farm people don't know about or don't identify with. But Cosby says,
I think people can identify with clean water. I think folks can identify with clean air and making sure that we keep our environment safe.
That's work that conservation engineers do every day. In fact, sometimes there's more work than there are engineers to do it. The government has been making record amounts of money available for farm conservation projects, and the USDA is needing to find more conservation engineers to help producers with those projects. Kevin Farmer told us,
we've been going through a big hiring surge as a result of the bipartisan infrastructure law and Inflation Reduction Act. And through those processes, we've grown our conservation programs and the need to deliver. So as a result, we've actually brought on more engineers. So we've done a lot of surge hiring, but right now we're at just over 1,100 engineers in the agency.
And in need of many more.
And we're doing everything we can to continue to recruit more talented young students from the universities.
This has been Agriculture USA. I'm Gary Crawford.
This is the AgNet News Hour, and we will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. For today's featured interview, we are continuing our conversation with Stanislaus County Agriculture Commissioner Linda Penfold. In yesterday's show, we talked about new pesticide regulations for the state of California, and there was a lot of information given out that you can get by listening to our podcast for the March 5th show. But also, Linda, what is the best way for growers and PCAs to get more information?
So first and foremost, I always recommend please use your county agriculture commissioner's offices as resources. Please do not be afraid to contact your local county agriculture commissioner. No question, you know, the only question that is not a good question is the question that is not asked. So they're a resource. They want to be able, we want to be able to get the information out. But you can also go to Department of, a number of counties will have this information on their webpage. Also, it's readily available. You can Google it through the Department of Pesticide Regulation. So in this regard, you just go on to Google and you put in California certification and training requirements, and it should be able to take you right to the DPR's page, excuse me.
So while we're talking about things that are new, anything new going on with neonics, bee protection?
Yes. So there was also a whole suite of neonicotinoid mitigation regulations that just came through. So here again, it regulates certain agricultural applications of pesticide products containing the active ingredients, and work with me here, I don't always pronounce these correctly, but it's the four main neonicotinoid pesticides. So it's imidacloprid, thimethoxam, dinotafurin, and clofianidin. I always have a fun time saying that one. So it's those four primary neonicotinoids. And what these regulations do is they are measures that are in place for crop-specific groups. These measures are focused on they are focused on the method and rate of restrictions, the timing of year for the applications, and there's also seasonal rate caps. And across the board, applications of these four neonicotinoid pesticides are prohibited during bloom. The information for the crop specific here again, those are readily available through the Department of Pesticide Regulations. But here again, a number of county agriculture commissioners can help work with folks too, especially when they're going to go get their permits, their restricted material permits or operator IDs. But they can also help get folks and pest control advisors the information. Because they are actually printed out there and they're based on each crop group. In the San Joaquin Valley, this is important because it affects a number of important crops such as berries and small fruits, bulb vegetables, cereal grains, citrus, cucurbit vegetables, fruiting vegetables like tomatoes, palm fruits, stone fruits, and tree crops. So it's a lot of changes on that.
That could affect a lot of growers of different crops as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it's really important that if their growers are looking at using these pesticides or considering the use of these pesticides, that they take a moment to research and look at those commodity-specific requirements.
Okay, so staying on the topic of not pronouncing things correctly, and this is even an easy one, but correct me if needed, Talone?
Yes, you did a great job, but we're talking about 1,3-dichloropropene, sometimes also called 1,3-D. There's also a suite of mitigation regulations that have come through here. And so what these regulations, and they just came into effect this past January as well. So I think the first thing is if anybody's going to be working with these, is considering using Talone or 1,3-D, it would be really wise to go and go online, and you can look up 1,3-D mitigation, but there is a field fumigation guide that's been adopted by regulation. And the title of it is 1,3-dichloropropene Field Fumigation Requirements Established January 1st, 2024. And this guide, because it's been adopted by regulation, it carries the same weight as regulation. But what it does is it describes requirements for 1,3-D setbacks around occupied structures. These are the zones where 1,3-D applications are prohibited, and also has related requirements that include minimum setback distances, minimum setback durations, maximum application rates, and maximum application block sizes. The guide also provides soil moisture requirements and restrictions to mitigate volatile organic compound emissions, also known as VOC emissions. What has to happen too is when the application is completed, a person needs to report the use. And so the field fumigation, the guide provides detailed descriptions of the allowed fumigation methods with the assigned fumigant method codes. And so it's fumigant method codes that need to be included in the pesticide use reports. So as an overview, what the regulations do, though, is they restrict the use of 1,3-D or Talone for only the use of production agriculture. So there's no other use now that's allowed for 1,3-D other than for production agriculture. It enacts setbacks from structures and restrictions for duration, rates, and block sizes. If totally impermeable film tarpaulins are going to be used, so if it can be applied through a tarp method, the tarps have to be from a list of approved tarps that have been approved by the director. This is an important one for growers. So for the field fumigation method, when you look at the regulations, the minimum it states in there is 12 inches below the surface. But for most fumigation methods that are used, especially for pre-plant, especially for orchard fumigations, the injection needs to be at least 24 inches below the soil. So that's quite a change for a lot of our growers. As well, the restrictions here, again, there are restrictions as to the area, time of year, and the methods. DPR also will be required to produce an annual report that includes evaluations of 1,3-D use, and they have air monitoring and their air monitoring results. And like I mentioned before, there will be some additional information that's going to be required in the pesticide reports and records. Most notably, an example is going to be the method codes. But here again, this is where when people are getting their pesticide use permits for these materials, counties usually have use restrictions that they issue with that. And that is a really good time to make sure that growers take a moment, talk it through with the county agriculture commissioner staff, so that way they're clear as to what needs to happen, and that way they can do the work that they need to do and move forward for preparing their fields for planting.
And we will finish our conversation with Stanislaus County Agriculture Commissioner Linda Penfold in tomorrow's show. You're listening to the AgNet News Hour, and now for more news. The USDA is currently surveying farmers, asking them how much of what crops they intend to plant. Gary Crawford has more.
Ah, Mendelssohn's classic spring song, reminding us that spring planting time is rapidly approaching. And of course, in ag circles, you don't need music to tell you the spring is approaching. Just listen to all the analysts and traders and others speculating about how much of what crops farmers are going to plant this spring.
There's always a lot of speculation out there, even leading up to this point, about what acreage is going to be.
Oh, yes, there are those who will theorize and speculate and predict and guess. But Lance Honig with USDA's Statistics Service says, yes, you may try to predict what farmers are going to do.
But this is the first opportunity to find out collectively what the farmers themselves are thinking.
This that Lance is talking about is the USDA's planting intentions report. Oh, yeah, that's Lance's way of getting me to call it by its official name, the Prospective Plantings Report. I call it the Planting Intentions Report because it's easier to say. But anyway,
the Prospective Plantings Report is always a highly anticipated report. Of course, it's USDA's first survey-based look at what planting intentions are for the upcoming season, that first gauge of what farmers expect to plant to the various crops during the upcoming crop season.
And to find out what they expect to plant,
we'll be reaching out to more than 70,000 producers, and we're really asking, how many acres of the various crops do you intend to plant at this time?
Subject changes because of weather or input prices or any number of 100 other factors. Results to be published in USDA's Planting Prospective Plantings Report in late March. Survey questionnaires were mailed out to selected producers back on February 17th. And so Lance says,
our goal is to get as many responses as we can. And so everybody gets an opportunity to either fill out that form and send it back in via the mail. You've got an opportunity to go out on the web and complete it there. But if you choose not to do that, we will start phoning producers right at the end of February. We'll do that for a couple of weeks.
And Lance says in some cases, if needed,
we might even send an enumerator out to the operation to collect that information.
USDA will shut down data collection March 17th with the little early there, Lance, with the prospective plantings report due out when?
Noon Eastern time.
March 28th. This is Gary Crawford, very funny, Lance, reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
That's today's Top Agriculture News. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Brian German and Sabrina Halverson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.